I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Last Transport by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. Prologue. Saturday, April 9th, 2005. Krypton. Everything looks good, the elder of the two L brothers said to the other, looking up from a bank of instruments. The younger, his hair still black where his brothers had gone salt and pepper, nodded in concurrence. We're right on schedule, he said. You two had better get to orbit, Zor-El said. Jor-El nodded again. I'd feel better if you were coming with us, he said, but Zor-El shook his head. No, no, he said. Someone has to coordinate things from here until the last ship leaves, and it's important for public morale that that be one of us. All the same. Zor-El laughed merrily and clapped his brother on the shoulder. Relax, Jor. The planet's only going to blow up sometime in the next 150 hours. What could go wrong? Jor-El couldn't help but laugh a little at that. The elder son of the House of El always had been able to maintain his good humor, even during what both of them now confidently calculated would be their homeworld's last week. He could crack a joke. A dark, morbid joke, admittedly, but a joke all the same. It was more than Jor-El thought he could have done. The Earthman who shared the room with them, a young Wedge Defense Force officer named Benjamin Hutchins and called Griffin by his friends, had a similar thought. He'd worked closely with the L brothers for the past 8 months, making first secret and then public arrangements for the evacuation of Krypton, and had come to like and respect them both. But of the two, he had to admit he enjoyed Zor-El's company a little more. The younger L was very intense, very driven, and his presence could get a bit overpowering after a while. I suppose you're right, Jor-El said. He held out a hand. I'll see you on New Krypton, brother. Zor-El took the hand and pulled Jor-El into a back-slapping hug. Get going, he said, and tell my nephew to be careful with the landing operations. It won't take those powers of his long to fade once he leaves the New Hope, and he's not used to being a pathetic mortal like the rest of us. Jor-El said he would pass the message along, then turned and went down the corridor to the docking ring. Zor-El turned to Griffin with a smile. I suppose you're going to try to convince me to come along as well, Commander. Griffin chuckled. No, I've learned better in the time I've spent here. Then, sobering, he added, But I wish you'd at least send your family with us. Zor-El nodded. And I wish they'd go, my friend, but, well, we Els have stubborn wives and daughters. It's a family tradition. That got a small laugh out of Griffin, who had come to know the L brothers' families well in his time on Krypton. Anyway, you don't need to worry, Zor-El went on, more seriously. I promise you, even if something happens to me, Kara will be on the last transport to leave Krypton. Griffin smiled. She'd better, he said mock-threateningly, and then shook the Kryptonian's hand. Good luck, Zor-El. Go with Rao, my friend, Zor-El replied. I'll see you later. Griffin headed down the same corridor Jor-El had taken, deep in thought. He didn't notice that there was someone waiting next to the hatch at the end of the hall until he had almost reached her. Once he did notice, he smiled. Kara Zor-El was 15 and had inherited her father's intense curiosity about more or less everything. Where most Kryptonians were suspicious of outsiders, planet had deliberately avoided contact with the greater galaxy for centuries, knowing about but declining to participate in the interstellar culture and commerce of the United Galactica. Kara had been thrilled to discover that her father's mysterious houseguest was not, in fact, from South Korax at all, but rather an Earthman from the Sol system. When he wasn't working with her father and uncle to arrange the evacuation of her homeworld, she had a habit of cornering Griffin and bombarding him with questions about the outside galaxy. Griffin, who generally didn't get on all that well with kids, found himself rather taken by her enthusiasm and lack of affectation. His lover, Kay Morgan, who joined him on Krypton in the second month of the mission, kidded him mercilessly about the young Kryptonian's obvious fascination. Even today, with the destruction of her home planet looming and the evacuation of its people well underway, Kara looked more interested and eager than worried or upset. "Decided to come out with us after all?" he asked, but she shook her head. "No, Mom and I are staying here with Dad. We'll be out on the Twilight Vanguard as planned," she said. "I just wanted to say goodbye to you and Uncle Jor before you leave." Griffin patted her shoulder. "Take care of yourself," he said. "Make sure your old man's not so fascinated by the breakup that he forgets to leave." Kara gave him a wry grin. "Why do you think Mom and I are staying with him?" she asked. Then she became serious, gave him a quick hug with the slightly furtive awkwardness of a teenager, and told him she'd see him soon. It would be customary at this point to note that Griffin had a bad feeling as he went through the hatch, dogged it behind him, and climbed up to the control cabin of the WDF Horizon T dropship docked at the top of Zor-El's tower, that he paused for a moment on the other side of the hatch in thought, then shook it off and continued on. That would, however, not be true. He was a little tense, yes. Being on a planet that had scheduled itself for demolition would do that to a person. But he was also confident. The L brothers were Krypton's most brilliant scientists, and other great minds had collaborated in the evacuation planning as well. It was a big job, but it was still a job, and so far it was going well. He was cheerful as he strapped into the Horizon's pilot seat and undocked from the tower, and cheerful as he arrived, half an hour later, on the bridge of the WDF's flagship, the mighty Superdimension Fortress No. 17, Wayward Sun. The bridge's forward holotank was projecting a vast three-dimensional image of Krypton, overlaid with colored lines and moving blips showing the vectors of outbound vessels. The evacuation of Krypton was one of the biggest personnel spacelifts ever attempted, the wholesale relocation of almost half a billion people. Hundreds of vessels were involved, including WDF transport command ships, chartered freighters and liners, and a number of warships belonging to the Royal Seleucian Navy, all under the master coordination of the SDF-17's comm crew in orbit and Zor-El on the ground. Megazone, the WDF's supreme commander, slouched in his command seat, watching the evacuation unfold. He turned his head at the sound of the main bridge doors to see Griffin and Jor-El entering. "Yo," he said, raising a hand. "Looks like it's going pretty well." Jor-El nodded, went to the science station, picked up a headset, and started coordinating with his brother, monitoring Krypton's condition as ships landed, loaded, and left at rallying points in all the major cities. Griffin continued on into the bridge, stopping next to Zoner's seat. "So far, so good," he said. "Zor-El stayed behind?" Zoner asked. "He and his family are coming off on the Twilight Vanguard." "Well, I guess somebody had to be the last to leave." Griffin nodded, then went to his executive officer's station, a freestanding, three-quarter enclosed workstation not far from the con, and put on a headset to monitor the L brothers and the rest of the comm traffic. For 6 more hours, the evacuation went like clockwork, as the precisely tuned rotation of ships removed more than 50 million people per hour from the doomed planet. A few of the evac ships suffered FTL drive failures, but the plan accounted for that. Those ships moved instead to positions near the Wayward Sun, where they could ride the fortress's space fold out when the operation was complete. The atmosphere on the SDF-17's bridge was tense but upbeat, the air of a well-trained crew doing a hard job with every expectation of success. Until Jor-El's voice suddenly cut through the low hum of operations chatter. "Core fluctuations just jumped 84%. I'm showing fault activity everywhere. Zor, can you confirm my readings?" In his headset's earpiece, Griffin heard Zor-El's reply, flattened slightly by the narrow band of the digital signal. "Confirmed. This is it. The core implosion's begun." "Get to your ship," Jor-El snapped. "There's no more time." "Too late," Zor-El replied, his signal beginning to break up. "No time to... quake... collapsing... with Rao." "Zor-El!" Jor-El cried, but the channel was dead. Zoner leaned forward, his eyes alert. "Jor-El," he said. "How long?" Jor-El shook himself and plied the science station's controls. "Not long," he said. Zor-El was right, the core's imploding. Radiation levels are 120% above red line and rising. He turned and made eye contact with the WDF commander. 4 minutes, no more. Zoner turned to Griffin. How many ships are down there? 4. Make it 3. The Radiant 7 just lifted off, and the next wave is inbound in hyperspace, ETA 10 minutes. Pull 'em, Zoner said. Griffin nodded and flipped some switches. Command to Evcon. Abort, abort. All inbound ships, abort. All down ships, lift off immediately. He listened for a moment, then turned to Zoner. They won't make it. Twilight Vanguard's repulsors are cold, and Daikon Vortex is trapped under debris from a boarding tower collapse. Zoner sat and watched the immobile icons flashing on Krypton's holographic surface for a moment. Visible rifts were now appearing in the planet as the crust started to break up. According to Jor-El's calculations, Krypton's highly radioactive core was collapsing, effectively serving as the tamping charge in the gigantic nuclear bomb the planet had become. When the collapse reached the critical point, Krypton would explode with enough force to annihilate even the wayward sun at this range, to say nothing of the smaller, more fragile evac ships still hustling toward their hyperspace jump points, and the small group of crippled transports sheltering in the lee of the fortress. For 1 minute, he let himself hope that the slippage in Krypton's condition would stop as capriciously as it started, arresting the slide long enough for the remaining ships to escape. But it didn't. Griff, he said at the end of the minute. Delta Green. Griffin instantly thumbed his comm panel to all call. STF-17 to all ships. Delta Green, Delta Green. Abandon your evac routes and form on us. Emergency spacefold in 1 minute. Mark. At the engineering station, Rerob Mandeville worked his own controls. The SDF-17's internal lighting went red as the voice of Eve, the ship's computer, announced throughout the hall. Emergency spacefold, in 1 minute. Crew members, secure all stations and return your seats to the upright and locked position. 48 seconds later, Krypton exploded, sending debris, hard radiation, and a massive subspace shockwave streaking outward toward the SDF-17 and its swarm of evac ships. The shockwave overtook and vaporized the Calufrax Purser, the last ship to lift off, within 2 seconds of the blast. Zoner gripped the arms of his command chair and watched the shockwave racing toward his ship. The Radiant 7, a small but game transport, strained to outrace the wave, its stout Corellian engines firewalled. But the coruscating curtain of emerald energy was visibly catching up to the little red vessel. Rerob bent over his panel, applying all his skill to the task of shaving as many milliseconds off the spacefold countdown as he could. The rest just held their breath. Space bent as the SDF-17's reflex drive clawed at it. Chunks of matter, until very recently pieces of the planet Krypton, driven before the shockwave that had erupted outward from the core, smashed against the SDF-17's deflector shields. A few burst through to plow into the fortress's armor, crumpling and bending massive plates of one of the galaxy's most durable alloys. One struck and obliterated the unfortunate transport Lindell Lancer and the 150,000 terrified Kryptonians aboard. The shockwave roared in behind. There was an almost audible groan and an outpouring of white light, and then the flotilla was gone, leaving the shockwave to streak outward and spend itself against Krypton's former moon, blasting the suddenly orphaned planetoid to rubble. Zoner blinked, his eyes dazzled slightly by the green brilliance that had filled the forward viewpoints beyond the holotank, and saw nothing out there now but the beautiful darkness of space. "Spacefold complete," Eve's voice announced, and the bridge lights returned to normal. "Griff?" Zoner asked. How'd we do? Griffin consulted his instruments. Lindell Lancer and Calufrax Purser are off the board, he said. All other ships that lifted off accounted for. Zoner raised an eyebrow. Even the Radiant 7? They crossed our fold threshold with 0.127 seconds to spare. Zoner let out a low whistle. Captain Tarvin gets a bonus. Captain Tarvin's engineer gets a bonus, Rerob said. And so does ours, Zoner agreed. Good work, Rob. Then he turned back to Griffin and said, How many were left behind? Griffin consulted his console. We don't have exact headcounts for all the ships yet, but I estimate about 120 million. Zoner slumped. A quarter of the population. He looked at Jor-El, who was sitting at the science station, his face blank. I'm sorry, Jor-El. The Kryptonian scientist shook his head, seeming to come out of a reverie, and turned to face the WDF commander. It wasn't your fault, he said. The core instability made an exact timetable impossible. You did an incredible job saving as many as you did. Jor-El sat back, looking suddenly exhausted, and added, Without your help, none of us would have survived. Zoner nodded, though he didn't look convinced. Then he turned to Griffin and said, Regroup the survivors and let's get started setting them down. Rerob, I want a complete damage survey. We took some hits from that initial debris surge. Griffin set to his work, his mind numb. He'd lost friends before. Being a wedge defender wasn't the galaxy's safest job. But he'd never seen a whole planet wiped out, and the toll was almost more than his mind could grasp, even with the remarkable achievement the partial rescue still was. And he couldn't help feel that it was all a little hollow for him. He felt a hand on his shoulder, turned, and saw Kay standing there, a sad little smile on her face. He covered her hand with his and gave it a squeeze, then got back to work. She stayed where she was. As weapons officer, she had nothing she needed to be doing right now, anyway, and she knew he could use the support. She felt much the same, after all. She knew how much Kara had been looking forward to exploring her people's new homeworld. The resettlement of nearly 75% of Krypton's population was hailed as a triumph throughout the galaxy. Accolades and honors poured in on all the evacuation's prime movers. Jor-El was elected chairman of the Science Council when that office was opened to voting again in 2007. For their efforts, many WDF and RSN personnel and all crew of private starships involved received medals. Griffin, the lead WDF officer on the project, was awarded the Royal Seleucian Lifesavers Medal and the Kryptonian Cross. They built statues of the three who had masterminded the evacuation in the central square of Kandor, the capital of New Krypton. Though he returned to New Krypton many times in his subsequent career, Griffin never went to see them. Wednesday, April 21st, 2410, 1:17 a.m., Zeta Cygni, Cygnus Sector. Catherine Willows had been to a lot of odd places in her time as a crime scene investigator for the International Police, but she had to admit that this was one of the oddest. And so close to home, too. She lived inside the Zeta Cygni Dyson Sphere for all of her adult life, and in that time she'd never once seen the outside surface of the sphere up close. Very few people ever did, but here she was, standing on the outside. From this close, it didn't seem at all like the surface of a sphere, of course. The thing was so utterly, mind-bogglingly vast that she felt as if she were standing on an enormous flat plane of dark gray metal, stretching off to infinity in all directions, an infinity made somehow more, not less profound, by the fact that beyond the small pool of white light cast by the headlamps of Gil Grissom's workbee, it was soaked in the utter blackness of deep space. There was a star nearby, but that star was inside the sphere. Wow. Kath heard one of her co-workers say over the narrow-band radio in her spacesuit helmet. For a moment, she thought Sarah Seidel was engaging in the same kind of wool-gathering she'd just been doing. But then she realized that Sarah, ever businesslike, was looking at, and presumably talking about, what they'd come out to deal with. From where Kath was standing, it looked like a big black smear on the metal surface, almost like a blaster scar on starship armor, but much larger. Grissom maneuvered his workbee so that it hovered only a few inches above the surface, pivoting it so that its floodlights would illuminate the largest possible area, then switch them on. Immediately, a bigger expanse of the sphere's surface was bathed in brilliant white light. Kath blinked, then whistled at what the lights revealed. The black smear was much bigger than it had initially looked, and it led to an actual deformation of the sphere surface, a trough carved into the metallic expanse. Its edges rippled with space-frozen melt patterns, the metal heated and pushed aside by the impact of something fast-moving and hot. "Holy cow," Nick Stokes muttered, crouching to have a closer look at the melted edge. "This is duophasic tritanium with a carbon-neutronium jacket. Whatever did this had to be moving." The four space-suited investigators looked at each other, then slowly started following the deepening trench carved into the sphere's surface. Grissom's work bee idled along behind them, its lights gradually revealing more and more of the damage until... "My God," Sarah blurted. Nearly half a mile from where it began, the trench bloomed into a teardrop-shaped crater almost 100 yards across. Bits of twisted, fractured golden metal lay scattered everywhere, and at the center of the crater... "Sphere Control, this is Grissom," the team leader radioed. "I need an EOD survey unit at my location ASAP." The Wedge Defense Force weapons specialist, who arrived a few minutes later, scanned the object at the bottom of the crater with an array of portable sensors, consulted his readings, and reported that he didn't know what the thing was, but whatever it wasn't a weapon. Based on his findings, the IPO controller at SphereCon cleared the team to retrieve the object, after photographing and logging its position, and transport it to their lab in New Avalon for further examination. A TACDIV transport unit removed it carefully from the crater and put it on repulsor stands in the night shift's vehicle garage, there to be examined at leisure. While the rest of the team organized and cataloged the smaller bits of wreckage in one of the situation rooms, Grissom paced around the biggest piece, speaking into a microcorder. "Object is a metallic ovoid, roughly 12 feet long and 4 feet in diameter at its thickest point," he noted. "A crystalline panel approximately 2 feet square is set into it a bit to one side of the center line. Vestiges of fins and thruster modules destroyed in the crash indicate the window, if that's what it is on top. My initial impression is that it's some kind of survival pod, but it doesn't conform to any standard design type I've ever seen." Grissom ran his fingertips along the gold-tinted side of the object, tapped them lightly against the opalescent crystal. "External scans can't tell us if there's anyone in it, if in fact it is a life pod. Design unknown. Point of origin unknown." He switched off the recorder and pocketed it. "What are you?" he asked the object quietly. Then he paused, noticing something, and clicked the recorder on again. "There's an engraved panel in front of the window," he said. "It has markings on it that look intentional. Probably writing." He looked up, saw lab tech Greg Sanders walking past the garage entrance, and called, "Greg!"
"Yo,
sir," Greg said, pivoting automatically. "Get a scan of this," Grissom said, pointing to the engraved plate, "and run it through the translator. I want to know what it says." The night shift ended and the day shift began, but no one from Grissom's crew went home. The mystery of the curious object was too compelling. Each member of the crew ran down leads, cross-checked facts, and dug into databases. It was almost noon when they regrouped in Grissom's office. "I pulled the SphereCon sensor logs for the period immediately preceding the crash," Sarah reported, "but they only raise more questions. It turns out the object's been on SphereCon's radar for months. They first picked it up last October at the outer edge of the system inbound. At first they thought it was a comet, until they realized it was traveling at relativistic speed." Warwick Brown raised an eyebrow. "How relativistic?" he asked. "Their estimate was 99.99% of light speed," Sarah replied. Warwick whistled. Sarah nodded and went on, "Its vector showed it was going to miss the sphere, so they didn't think anything of it until this morning, when it abruptly changed course, to put it on a direct run into the inner system, then began to decelerate. The plot shows it was headed for Zeta Cygni II. From the deformation to the sphere surface, I'd say it was doing about 1/4 light speed when it hit," Nick said. "No idea what it's made of, but whatever it is, it's damn tough," Catherine said. Greg's got samples for the spectrometer, but he's had a hard time even prepping them. The stuff's so resistant. Has he had a chance to get that engraving translated yet? Grissom asked, but Catherine shook her head. I didn't think the metallurgy would take him all morning, so I asked him to do it first, she said. Sorry. She pulled a photograph from a file folder she held. He did get it scanned, but I don't... There was a knock at the door. Grissom looked up to see the ginger-haired form of Adam Savage, a local visual effects technician and sometime helper with case reconstructions, outside his glassed-in office. He gestured, and Adam stepped in. Sorry to interrupt, but I... His eye fell on the photo Catherine was holding. What the... You recognize that? Grissom said. Savage took the photo and rotated it 180 degrees. It's Kryptonese, he said, then began to read with a growing tone of fascination in his voice. This is my daughter, Kara Zor-El, from the now-dead planet Krypton. Treat her as you would your own child, for you will see the treasure she will be for your world. He blinked, then turned to Catherine. This is incredible. Where did you find it? Grissom stared at him for a second, then picked up the phone on his desk. This is Grissom in CSI, he said. I need to speak to the chief immediately, please. IPO Chief Benjamin Hutchins, almost universally known as Griffin, arrived 10 minutes later, and Grissom immediately took him to the garage. The whole team and Savage trailed behind, consumed with intense curiosity, as the chief entered the garage and paused to look at the object. My God, he murmured. It is. It's the core pod of one of Jor-El's survival rockets. Like the one he sent his son to Earth aboard in 1938, before Krypton's core instability went into remission, Adam mused. Bigger than that, but the same basic design, yes, Griffin said, running a hand gently over the blunt prow of the pod. But if it is Kara's, if Zor-El managed to send her on her way before the planet blew in 2005, why is it just getting here now? I think I have that, Warwick said, scribbling on a page of his notebook. Sarah, you said Sphericon tracked it entering the system at a high fraction of light speed? 99.99%, give or take a 9, Sarah replied. Warwick nodded, scribbled a little more, then looked up. Krypton was a little more than 400 light-years from here, he said. Griffin nodded. Gravitational and radiation levels were fluctuating wildly in Krypton's last minutes, he said. The pod must have suffered a hyperdrive failure. It accelerated to light-speed, but didn't jump to hyperspace, Warwick agreed. That explains why it hit the sphere, too, Nick said. If it was launched 400 years ago, whoever programmed the course wouldn't have been expecting there to be a wall there. Why would Zor-El send his daughter to Zeta Cygni II? Adam wondered aloud. Because I lived there, Griffin said, walking slowly down one side of the pod. The message you translated is for me. Kay and I lived with Zor-El and his family for months, planning the evacuation of Krypton. He chuckled. Treat her as you would your own child. That was an inside joke between Zor-El and his wife Allura and us. They asked us once whether we were going to have children. That was kind of an awkward question at the time. I was only 32. So I tried to laugh it off. Said if I ever decided I needed a kid, I'd just take Kara home with me. He paused, looking more closely at the pod, and then placed his right hand flat against a slightly depressed spot on its side, just below the crystalline panel. For a moment, nothing happened. Then there was a high chiming sound, the depression glowed, and the panel released a small cloud of steam from all around its edge before sliding back out of the way. When the vapor cleared, it revealed the unconscious but intact form of a blonde-haired teenage girl, dressed in an old-fashioned Kryptonian robe in white and blue. As the others crowded up behind him, Griffin reached into a pocket of his coat, pulled out a tricorder, and scanned her, then smiled. Alpha hibernation, he said. When she's removed from the pod, she'll switch from that to normal sleep in an hour or so. I'm amazed she survived the impact, even as sturdy as this pod is, Catherine said. Griffin grinned and pointed at a row of glowing lights built into the rim of the pod hatch. "Yellow sun spectral lamps," he said. "The ultimate crew protection system, if you're talking Kryptonian spacecraft. She's probably been charging up since she was launched." "Which, for her, might have been only a few years ago, depending on just how close to light speed she got," Warwick said. "But even so..." Griffin put his tricorder away and chuckled, wiping a tear from his eye. "Sor-El, you clever bastard," he said, mostly to himself. "You kept your promise after all." Then, without further ceremony, he reached into the pod and gathered the girl up in his arms. "Whoa, hey, what are you doing?" Nick asked. "Treat her as you would your own child," Griffin said. "I wouldn't leave my own child to wake up on an exam table in a science lab. No offense, guys. I'm taking her home." "Are you sure that's wise?" Grissom asked diplomatically. "No," Griffin replied, "but it's what I have to do." Grissom smiled slightly and stepped out of the way. "Quickly, Kara, quickly. There's no time to argue." Her father's voice, calm and rational even at a moment like this, with the planet literally coming down around their ears. The spire teetered with a metallic groan. Outside, fountains of green fire were bursting out of the ground, their radiations sickening, dizzying. Krypton was dying, loudly and cataclysmically dying, and it was too soon. The family's escape route was cut off. Kara followed Zor-El uncomprehendingly down a shuddering corridor, her mother at her heels. When she saw what lay in the room at the end, she understood. Her eyes filled with tears as her father punched keys in the crystal hatch of the escape rocket, her uncle Jor's design, slid back. "Daddy? Daddy, no," Kara said. "I can't leave you and Mom here to..." Zor-El shook his head. "You can, and you will," he said firmly. "No," she cried. "You..." "Kara," said Allura gently, her soft voice cutting through the chaos around them. She put a hand on her daughter's shoulder and went on. "I know it will be hard, going on without us, but think about how we feel. If you had a daughter, would you want her to die?" Kara opened her mouth, but nothing came out for a moment. Then she closed it, shook her head, and said quietly, "No." "Then please, for our sake, go." "But where?" the girl asked as she climbed, shaking, into the escape rocket's survival pod. "The only place I can," Zor-El told her as he tabbed controls on the panel in front of her. The building lurched, groaned, nearly pitching Zor-El into the pod after his daughter. He caught himself on the hatch combing, cursed, and finished keying the sequence into the life support computer. "Sleep now, Kara. When you wake, you will be with friends. I made a promise." Realizing what he meant, she tried to smile bravely, but it wouldn't come. The alpha wave inducer was already attacking her consciousness. The room, the falling rubble, the dreadful din, all fading away. With an effort, she looked past Zor-El's shoulder at Allura, saw her mother's tear-streaked face wearing a sad smile of goodbye. Zor-El put his hand gently to the side of her face, then flipped another control. Bright lights glowed to life all around, and even as the heaviness of hibernation shut down her mind, Kara felt a delicious lightness and sense of well-being flood through her body. It gave her a moment's extra consciousness as her father leaned close and kissed her forehead. "Goodbye, my beloved daughter," Zor-El said. "Enjoy your life. For your mother and me. Be happy." Kara felt her eyelids flutter, struggled to hold them up.
I will."
Zor-El smiled. "I love you, Kara," he said. Kara marshaled all her strength to reply,
"I love you too, Daddy."
The last thing she saw before the blackness finally swept over her was her father's face. There were no dreams. Once the alpha inducer had done its work and put her consciousness safely out of action, The hibernation system shut down her body almost altogether. A deeply unpleasant experience if undertaken while awake. Maintaining only the barest imaginable processes of life. Thanks to the failed drive system, the journey from doomed Krypton to Zeta Cygni took more than 4 centuries. Thanks to the relativistic time dilation encountered at those speeds, only about 1/100th of that span of time passed within the pod itself, and in 4 years of hibernation, Kara aged only a few hours. She woke normally, as if she'd just settled down for a nap those few hours ago, to find herself tucked into a comfortable bed in a dark, cool room. There was a figure sitting in a chair next to the bed, arms folded, head bowed, dozing. Though the room was dark, she could easily tell that much. All her senses felt hyper-extended, hyper-acute. She couldn't see anyone, but she could easily hear him breathing. For that matter, if she concentrated a little, she could hear his heartbeat clearly. The lights in the pod, she realized, tuned to the output of a yellow sun. Uncle Jor thought of everything. The man in the chair heard her moving and woke immediately, then reached over and switched on a light. So it was that the first thing Kara Zor-El saw when the darkness was wiped away was Griffin's face. She caught a breath at the sight of him, remembering her father's promise. When you wake, you will be with friends. But something was wrong. He looked older. When she had last seen him, to her, just hours before, he'd seemed not all that much older than she was, maybe a year or two out of secondary school, clean-shaven and ponytailed. Now he looked about Jor-El's age, a man in full, with a close-trimmed beard and his hair clipped and parted. He smiled and said quietly, "Hello, Kara. I'm glad you made it." She smiled, too, but then her eyes filled with tears as everything crashed in on her at once. Krypton's destruction she had been expecting, but her parents, she had just seen them. And now, it was quite obvious, they had been dead for years. Griffin moved from the chair to the edge of the bed, and she grabbed hold of him and cried. Kara was shaky for the first couple of days. Griffin expected this and was patient. The weather was rotten anyway, cold and damp and a bit sleety. Not a good time to introduce anyone to New Avalon. When she was ready, he explained where and when she was and how she'd come to be there. As so often in situations like this, one of Derek Bacon's books, in this case the redoubtable So You've Become Unstuck in Time, a survival guide for the chronically displaced, came in very handy. On Friday, he had to go to work for a little while, mainly to file paperwork to do with her arrival and notify the appropriate people in the appropriate places. By then, she was feeling not great, but better, and Griffin thought she might enjoy chatting for a while with some people closer to her own age. She would, after all, eventually want to know someone other than him. The wry quip got the first laugh she'd mustered since awakening, and as he left, she sat down at the datacom console in the den to see what was going on out in the electronic world. Krypton hadn't been on the internet, though it had possessed one of the galaxy's most sophisticated planetary computing systems in its day. But the interface tools weren't hard to figure out, especially after the primer Kara had received from So You've Become Unstuck in Time. It wasn't long before she was surfing the net with confidence, and, with a slightly guilty little smile, poking through Griffin's bookmarks. There were a hell of a lot of them, and if Kara was being honest, most of them were disappointingly mundane. There was only so much interest she could muster for aerospace rumor sites and pages tracking the results of Spaceliner crash investigations. She hadn't found the good stuff yet when the telephone next to the desk rang. After debating with herself for a couple of rings, Kara shrugged and picked it up. The voice at the other end was calm and pleasant, but what it said in response to her, "Hello?" surprised her. "Miss Kara Zor-El, please." Speaking. "Ah, good. Miss Zor-El, my name is Victor Sage. I'm a reporter." Kara blinked. "How did you know I was here?" A dry chuckle. "I'm a reporter," Sage repeated. "But, no, I wish I could claim it was some journalistic omniscience that told me who and where you were, but that would be a lie. Griffin called me. He knows the story of your miraculous escape from Krypton is going to break sooner or later, and he wanted to make sure the first reporter to track you down was someone you could trust.
I'm not sure I...
Don't say anything right now, Sage said. Check it with him first. Just be aware that he's right. The story will break, and soon. When that happens, you will need to be careful who you talk to. There are a lot of crazies out there.
Okay, look, where can I reach you if...
Griffin has my number, Sage replied. Or you can get me through the city desk at the Cornet Scientifer. Goodbye for now. Kara looked at the dead phone for a few seconds, then put it down, turned back to the terminal, and thoughtfully plugged the name Victor Sage into the search engine. This led her, in a convoluted manner familiar to habitual data searchers, to an archive of articles he, or at least someone by that name, had done for the New Avalon Cornet Scientifer. Sage's byline ran atop articles that spanned a surprisingly broad range of topics, but overall the impression they gave was of an old-fashioned investigative reporter who relished digging out corruption in power structures. A lot of his pieces were devastatingly researched rebuttals of various claims made by the Earth Alliance or United Federation of Planets, whose political situations Kara only vaguely understood. Of more local interest was some coverage he had given a local group of costumed heroes called the Titans. The normally critical Sage seemed to have mostly good things to say about them, though the impression his writing gave was that they had only earned his praise after a period of skepticism. What did he want to talk to her about, really? Did he think her appearance was some kind of hoax that he hoped to debunk? She had no desire to be badgered by someone who had already decided not to believe what she said. On the other hand, if he was genuinely fair as well as skeptical, that could be for the best. If she could convince him that she was for real, public acceptance might follow more easily. But wait, what did she care about public acceptance? She didn't need the public to accept her. It wasn't like she was planning to run for office or anything. All she wanted to do was try to put her life back in some semblance of order and, well, actually... She went looking for more information on this group called the Titans. Maybe if she could get in touch with them, she could learn more about this reporter, Sage. He'd obviously talked to them quite a bit in the course of the many pieces he'd done about them for the paper. Surely they'd have some impression of him they could share. It took her half an hour to track down a contact for them in the form of an International Police internal chat room, another find from Griffin's bookmark file. With faint trepidation, she entered the channel. Several Titans were online, though not all were active. To her mild surprise, they'd already heard about her. It seemed that two of their number worked closely with Griffin, the Chief, they called him, and had told the others all about the mysterious arrival from Krypton who was crashing at the Chief's place. They were friendly and welcoming, immediately putting her at her ease, and before long they were chatting like they'd known each other for years. There were five of them active at the moment. Robin, who seemed to be the leader, was serious but not harsh. Cyborg had a lighter touch, a bit on the whimsical side. Raven, who was one of the ones who worked with the Chief, didn't say much, but what she did say was measured and wise. Beast Boy wasn't actually in New Avalon. He'd moved out to the Rim to work in movies, and it was obvious just from this small sampling that he and Cyborg must have been a comedy duo when the whole team was together. Flash did most of the talking, in a fast-paced, slightly telegraphic style that suffered from numerous typos. He was very friendly and seemed the most eager to make a new friend. After some discussion of Vic Sage, "He's okay," was the general consensus, and the general situation, the talk turned to superpowers. Kara hadn't actually had hers for long, and since she hadn't left the house since regaining consciousness, she'd barely tested any of them, apart from a little levitating. Flash seemed to find that astounding, that anyone would wake up one day to find she had superpowers and not immediately be outside trying them all out. But after reflecting on her overall situation, he seemed to accept that maybe she'd had other things on her mind. Flash: "But you have heat vision?" Kara: "I haven't tried it, but I guess I must." flash. Awesome. I don't have any attack pores. I just hit things with my nads at 1,000 times a sec-nod. When she was able to stop laughing and focus on the screen again, Kara composed herself and typed only, "Kara, sounds painful." Cyborg dies. Robin, Beast Boy, can't breathe. Flash, hands, jeez. Raven, you have to excuse Flash. He types faster than he can think. Batgirl has joined Channel Titans. Batgirl, yo guys, what's up? Robin, Wally was just telling us all about a new combat move he invented. Raven, yes, tell her about it, Wally. Flash, I hey you all. They chatted for nearly an hour more before Kara, noting that the afternoon was fleeing, typed, Kara, I need to go downstairs and talk to G about this Sage thing. Catch you guys later? Robin, sure, it was nice meeting you. Batgirl, stop by the tower sometime. Cyborg, yeah, really, anytime you like. Somebody's always here. Flash, tonight is Takto Knig. Raven, are we watching a movie? Beast Boy, I just sent Sai a boot of my new flick. Raven, ye gods, is it in Japanese? Beast Boy, it's subtitled, kind of. Kara, that sounds like fun. I'll see if I can make it. Bye. Kara has quit, leaving. Right, downtown to see the chief. Kara got dressed. The chief's youngest daughter was only a little older than she was, and away at school, so there was plenty to wear, though it took a little searching to find anything she really considered presentable, and dug around in the desk for the New Avalon subway map. Take it easy, go slow, get downtown like a normal person. That was the ticket. When she stepped outside and discovered that the weather had cleared, she almost abandoned that plan. The bright blue sky and the brilliant yellow sun shining from it reminded her that, in this place, she was anything but a normal person. Just standing in the light of Zeta Cygni made her feel like the hard part would be staying on the ground. Still, there was no sense alarming the neighbors, so she kept resolutely to her plan and walked to the end station.